You tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Do proteins hold the key to the past? It's a question one New Yorker writer explored in a deep dive into the exploding field of proteomics. As scientists begin to re-examine the pages of historic texts, they're learning remarkable things about the people who once handled these documents, from the food they ate to the diseases they might have carried. One such study happened right here in Washington at the Folger Shakespeare Library, where a swab from a 400-year-old Bible found DNA belonging to at least one Northern European who had acne. Could future studies in the field of proteomics paint a more complete portrait of the bard himself? Joining us to talk about this is Julie Segre. She is a geneticist and senior investigator in the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH, the National Institutes of Health. Julie Segre, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Mike Whitmore is the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Mike, good to see you again.
Great to be back, Kojo.
And joining us from London is Sam Knight. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker based in London. He wrote an article entitled, Do Proteins Hold the Key to the Past? In the magazine's November 26th issue. Sam Knight, thank you for joining us.
Hello, my pleasure.
Sam, in the New Yorker article, you wrote about a new scientific technique used to scour the pages of old manuscripts for traces of the author's lives, including biological information. What kinds of traces have been found, and why are they so significant?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that this is a very kind of novel development and kind of application of a kind of science which is more commonly used in sort of big pharma or biotech or sort of things that we would sort of associate with sort of hard science. And we're really in the early stages of testing manuscripts and historical artifacts. And so I think we're talking about a series of studies really in the last 3 or 4 years that have looked at intriguing things like Chekhov's postcards is kind of one that's been looked at, Bulgakov's notebooks for a novel called Master and Margarita, and a kind of it's a handful of studies at this time, but we're getting intriguing kind of insights into diseases and even kind of food or other kind of real snippets of the lives that these authors lived.
What is this field of proteomics, and what's the potential that scientists see there, Sam?
So the way to think about proteomics, I'm really happy to be corrected by kind of Mike and Julie on this, because I feel like they will have a kind of a more refined sense of it than I will. But the way to think about proteomics is it's a bit like an atlas. It's an atlas of all the proteins and all the biological activity that's sort of taking place in a cell at any one moment. It's an unbelievably kind of ambitious part of kind of biology and chemistry at the moment. And when you begin to think about how you could apply those techniques to the past, it's almost kind of overwhelming to think about how you might bring that technology to bear on something like archaeological remains or archaeological finds. You're not just sort of talking about the things that you can hold in your hands, but you're also talking about tiny, tiny traces that sort of that shed a life on the lives of the people that handled them.
Julie Segre, I myself only learned the word proteomics in the last 24 hours or so. Care to expand on anything that Sam has said so far?
Sure. I've been a part of the Human Genome Project for 30 years now, and I think all of these omics-type fields, which just means basically a lot of it, trying to take it from I have a single gene to genomics, which is now I'm going to look at every single gene on every single chromosome. Proteomics is the same. We could think about a single protein like albumin, which is in red cells, but proteomics will take us to look at every single protein, as Sam was saying, in this atlas that the cell produces. There, in the same way that there is a slight variation, and the gene that encodes albumin would be slightly different between a cow and a pig, it would also be slightly different between you and me. And proteomics and genomics are both really exploiting those similarities and those differences to find these molecular signatures of life.
You have been doing this research locally here, including at the Folger Shakespeare Library, which we'll get into in a moment. But first, what kinds of molecules get left behind on historic documents, and how do you go about studying them?
It's an intriguing question because these are often, well, these are always microscopic and submicroscopic, which means that you can't see it with your eye. Even if you put a microscope on it, you can see that there's a film here. But we're now getting to the molecular level beyond even what you can see with your eye and finding that there are remnants that have been left behind. And those remnants have to do with what animal was used to make the paper for this book. And Mike and I are even exploring, could we understand who handled these books? These are similar questions that are being asked in scientific inquiries of forensics, and we're applying them to additional scholarly work.
Well, before I get to Mike's, scientists have analyzed ancient documents for decades, including things like carbon dating. But what's different about this? What's special about proteins?
Proteins, it's the level of resolution. It's the same way in which Sam was saying, when I look in the sky, if I look with my eye, I can see a few stars. If I look with a telescope, I could see more. If I go up with the Hubble telescope, that's what we're doing. We're going up and we're going into the cosmos, the places that you couldn't even see if you were standing here on Earth looking up with a high-powered telescope. These are all about the exploration, but the exploration is with things that are right here on Earth with us.
So that if 100, 200 years from now, someone were to find this desk at which I'm sitting with my hand on it right now, is it conceivable that that individual using this science would be able to say what my diet was like or what illnesses I may have been suffering from?
Well, that might be a bit of a stretch for us right now, but it's probably worth conserving this desk because in a few hundred years, we might have that technology. Right now, we could say it was Kojo, or maybe someone closely related to Kojo, who sat here, who put his hand here. And I don't even know that at this point, with modern technology looking at you, I could exactly tell you what it is that you eat and what's your genetic predisposition.
Mike Whitmore, what exactly was Project Dust Bunny, which was featured in Sam Knight's story, and what was the motivation behind it?
Well, Kojo, we got to know an archaeologist named Turi King, who was the person who identified the body of Richard III, the king that Shakespeare wrote about. He was dug up in a parking lot in Leicester, England. And she came to Washington to talk about her discoveries. And as I got to know her, it dawned on me that maybe there's an easier way to get DNA samples from people. You don't have to dig them up out of the ground because for hundreds and hundreds of years, people have been leaning over books. They've been handling them. They've been depositing skin and hair cells. And then they close the book and put it on a cool shelf, and it stays there, sometimes undisturbed, for centuries. And so as that idea started to unfold, we gathered a team. I reached out to Julie and said, do you think that we could harvest some samples from old books and understand more about the people who use them using the techniques that you use? And so with Julie and Turi King and Dr. Heather Wolf, our curator of manuscripts, and Renata Mesmer, who is the head of our conservation lab, we got together and we decided that we would take a sample using something like a Q-tip from the gutter, which is the seam where the pages come together, of a 400-year-old Bible. And so we took the sample and we sent it to the NIH. And about 11 months later, we got an email from Julie saying, we've successfully sequenced the DNA, mitochondrial DNA, of two individuals. We know their haplotype, which means the region they're from, and it looks like Northern Europe. And we've even found bacteria that suggest that maybe they had acne on their skin. So that was very interesting to us because it told us that in addition to having a research collection that we like to read, that a collection of books is also a bioarchive. And that means that when we work with the books, when we take them into the conservation lab to repair them or to see how they've been handled, there's dust and other material coming out of those books all the time. Now we know that we should be preserving that material. And so, as Julie said, in the future, we don't really know what we could learn from this material. So we've tried to start collecting it, and we've started to actively consider our collection, in addition to being a research tool for humanists, as also being a resource for information about the biological past, down to the individual person.
I think you may have just explained it already, but I'll ask you to explain it some more. Why was the project given the code name Project Dust Bunny?
Well, it seemed like a cute name for a project that might not work at all. I think it was Heather Wolf who said, let's call it Dust Bunny. But we were looking at these books in the conservation lab, and there really is sometimes bundles of hair and other stuff that you would think, well, I mean, why would I want to keep that? But, you know, you think of dust bunnies as things in the corner that you should ignore. And we just started with the assumption that maybe this is stuff we should ignore, but we want to check.
So I don't really have to touch the table at all. All I have to do is lean over these papers that are here. And if somebody salvages these papers at a later date, I will have deposited something on these papers, right, Julie?
Well, certainly if you would let me have access to those dust bunnies that I see over in the corner, we could probably track it down to you.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation. Of course, this is our year-end membership campaign, so we want to take care of that business. I'm Kojo Namdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about proteomics, our history in proteins, so to speak. We're talking with Mike Whitmore. He is director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Also joining us in studio is Julie Segre. She is a geneticist and senior investigator in the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH. And joining us from London is Sam Knight. He's a staff writer with the New Yorker. He's based in London. He wrote a piece titled, Do Proteins Hold the Key to the Past? In the magazine's November 26th issue. Sam, in order to write this piece, you went all over the world. You were in Israel, you were in Florence, you were in St. Petersburg. How did you land on the Shakespeare Folger Library?
Well, the story came about in a funny way. I wrote a story earlier in the year about something called the Fatberg. Did you guys ever hear about that? It was this horrible thing stuck in London's sewers. It was sort of full of sort of horrible things that we chuck out, but it's nonetheless a kind of a slice of how we live. And a few days after that, I got an email from a man called Gleb Zilberstein, who's an inventor based in Israel, who works in the field of proteomics and has developed a new technique for extracting these samples. And I got talking with Gleb, and he invited me to St. Petersburg to look at the manuscripts of Johannes Kepler, the 17th century astronomer. Hmm. And once you start kind of asking around, the field of proteomics as applied to old objects is not that big. And I quite quickly got onto the trail of a man called Professor Matthew Collins at Cambridge University, and he's worked with Mike before, and he kind of pointed me towards the Folger. So that's how the connection was made.
Mike, what possibilities do documents like, say, Shakespeare's personal papers hold when studied this way?
Well, you know, what we realized is that we don't know in the long term what we can learn from these documents. But if for some reason Shakespeare left a sample on one of the papers that he handled or documents, we in our collection have an indenture for the deed and sale of Blackfriars, a house in Blackfriars that Shakespeare executed in 1613, he would have held that in his hands. The wax seals on these documents are quite good for also finding DNA. So using some of the techniques that Turi used and some of the techniques that Julie's been describing, we could, in principle, match a sample from a living member of Shakespeare's family. It doesn't have to be a descendant, but it does need to go up the maternal line. It could go above him to his mother. And we could then use that sample to confirm that the sample from the document is from Shakespeare or his family. And that's a long shot. That's like a moonshot. But I think it does tell us that we should be very careful. We should start setting aside samples when we have them. And probably in the near to medium term, we should start to ask members of families from important Tudor and Stuart personalities, Francis Bacon, Margaret Cavendish, Elizabeth I, could we find ways of finding contemporary samples so that we could make those matches?
So that, Julie, when somebody like me gets overexcited about this and feel that, oh, within a matter of months, we'll know a great deal more about Shakespeare, it doesn't exactly work like that, does it?
Well, many of these scientific projects are an investment, but I think we always are looking for some early returns, and that would be what we did with Mike, that it is technically possible, given current technology, to sequence the DNA from the gutters of these books, and that would suggest that it's worth doing a larger analysis. So maybe you just have to be a little more modest in what you consider a quick win in these things, that it's, you know, it's amazing where we have come in the last 30 years. When I joined the Genome Project as a PhD student, we didn't have the sequence of the human genome. And it's amazing to me in my own life how much we have learned going from the sequence of a single human to the sequence of thousands of humans, and how much this has opened up. But I think this field is more like when you go out to Taos and they say, well, we keep parts of this, we don't even excavate them, because we know that new technology is coming. And it's the same way in which we are so grateful for the new advances in cancer therapies, that it's happening here too, where there are scientific advances that make it possible to do something that couldn't have been done 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And it's happening in our lifetimes.
Sam, you wrote, quoting here, that a small clutch of scientists believe this field of study has the potential to, quoting again, immensely expand our knowledge of the past. What response did you get after this story was published, particularly from those in the scientific community?
Well, I have to say, you know, reporting this story was completely fascinating, because I found for most of the time I was talking to people in two separate camps almost. I was talking to scientists and geneticists and people who were kind of very kind of clued into the latest advances in the technology and what was possible. And then I was also talking to historians and literary scholars about some of the texts that I'd been looking at. And you sense that both sides were eager to talk to one another to discuss what might be possible, but kind of the opportunities hadn't arisen yet, or we were at the early phases of this. I kept looking and looking for someone who could sort of hold both sides of the coin, as it were. In terms of when the article came out, I feel like it kind of it's been, you know, read in an interested way in libraries and archives, and people are starting to kind of sit up and think about what measures they might take, as Mike's been describing, about preserving books and artifacts for the future. I think, you know, there's a certain amount of kind of healthy skepticism, which I think is also completely fine. And I raised you know, some questions in the article about whether sort of chemists kind of charging into kind of old archives claiming to discover things about the past might be kind of unsettling to historians or traditional scholars. And I think there's been a certain amount of reaction to that, which I think is all sort of healthy. I think one of the fascinating kind of aspects of this is, and this is certainly how I experienced it doing the reporting, is it just makes you look differently at things that you thought you were already familiar with. It kind of shakes the tree and makes people reconsider, particularly, you know, old documents which might have been digitized by now and put into different formats and not forgotten about in terms of their contents, but forgotten about in terms of what they are as objects.
Well, one of the things I noticed in your article was that some of the scientists with whom you spoke and traveled found that there were some archivists who didn't want them to go near their materials at all, didn't want them to touch them. Is that changing?
This is early days, as Julie referred to, you know, a minute ago. You know, this is the kind of the beta testing phase. You know, I think it makes total sense if you're a conservator to kind of let someone else sort of take the plunge or wait for the field to kind of to have some more established systems and procedures or a technique that seems kind of superior to all the rest. I mean, I'm really interested to hear what Mike and Julie have to say about this. But one of my thoughts reporting the article is that there are sort of two strands to this. One is about these ambitious moonshots, as Mike described, of trying to identify individuals or their specific health conditions or their specific DNA. And then there's this actually much broader and I think more, in some ways, more kind of realistic field of work, which is about all the incidental stuff which gathers on the surface of objects, just giving us an insight into earlier societies or how people lived. You know, the paper that really got me interested in this was a study of deaths during a plague in Milan in 1630. And in that case, the archives were covered in maize and chickpea and carrots and tobacco and the diet and the things that the clerks were smoking. And all of those things are kind of logical. It's not surprising that someone was eating maize and chickpeas in Milan in 1630. But when you actually see them on the pages, the traces of these things, it makes the past, you know, very, 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 very tangible. And so I think there are kind of two strands to this. They say there's the curiosity about individual authors, but there's also the biological traces of earlier times.
Well, that part of the piece that you wrote is the one that I think got me most excited, so I'm going to quote it about the plague. They said, you wrote, they extracted more than 600 proteins from the plague records, including 17 from the family of Yersinia pestis. Along with traces of the plague, there were rat and mouse proteins, hints of goat milk and of anthrax bacteria, smatterings of tobacco, chickpea, rice, carrots, and maize, indicating the diet of the clerks who chronicled this disaster. But you asked Julie and Mike if they'd like to add anything to what you said, so go ahead, Julie.
It is absolutely a broad range, and the technology is making this possible. I think we might also learn something about the conservation process by doing this, that we could understand what are the bacteria and fungi and viruses living on this material. And that may help us to understand why does some paper disintegrate. So it's a dialogue and it feeds back and forth. But the archaeologic contributions are huge here. And it's the same way that we're interested when we find an archaeologic discovery of humans, and you can find what's in the fire pit and what animals were they living together with and who did they live close to. And there's just a way in which we want to understand what happened in the past.
Fascinating that the techniques that were typically used on living patients are now being used on what people would say are a bunch of old books. But we'll talk a little bit more about this when we come back. We're still taking your calls. This is our year-end membership campaign, so we're going to take a short break so that you can become a member or renew your membership now. And then when we come back, we'll continue with this conversation about our history and proteins. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back to our conversation about proteomics, our history in proteins. We're talking with Sam Knight. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's based in London. He wrote an article entitled, Do Proteins Hold the Key to the Past? You can find it in the magazine's November 26th issue. He joins us from London. Joining me in studio is Julie Segre. She's a geneticist and senior investigator in the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, NIH. Mike Whitmore is director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, and we're taking your calls. Sam Knight, something you mention in your article kind of surprised me, and that is that humanities scholars might not welcome this kind of scientific inquiry, this kind of scientific analysis. Why not?
I think that, you know, what we're talking about here is really, you know, cutting edge new technology. And, you know, one of the things that struck me during my reporting and was that unless some of these projects are kind of handled carefully in a kind of interdisciplinary way, then you've got, in theory anyway, the kind of the danger of sort of scientists kind of running loose with archives and old objects and not maybe sometimes not having a kind of a feel for the kind of all the context and the kind of the subtle interpretation of these objects and documents which have been going on for a long time. I think those conversations are at an early stage now and are very exciting. But there is, you know, there's just a kind of there's a difference between, you know, and you know, some of the stories that I do involve the past or the recent past. I was in an archive, you know, myself this morning, kind of on my own, kind of looking at old papers, having a lovely time. You know, science, especially at this kind of, you know, very innovative kind of edge, tends to be large teams, laboratories, funding, you know, where you might have sort of half a dozen investigators or something. There are sort of interesting kind of cultural differences between the way that some of these, the way that some of these questions have been approached.
Mike, you clearly see room for overlap in the sciences and the humanities. Why do you think some of your colleagues in the humanities don't agree, and what opportunities might they be missing?
Well, I think we're at a moment now where it pays to have an open mind about this. As in every field of study, people become polarized, and the humanities over the last 40 or 50 years, at times you meet people who work in the humanities who define themselves as being not scientists and keeping more than arm's length away from the kinds of things scientists do. And we do need to acknowledge that these are very different ways of making sense of the world. I might not look to proteomics, I certainly wouldn't, to help me understand how Hamlet feels in Act Two of that play. But I would want to ask questions and interest colleagues in the answers to the question of how, what made a person's life precious? What did that person feel his or her life meant? And how can we get answers to those questions by looking at the life world that they inhabited? If that person felt food stress because of a famine, and we're now seeing that books in the period are showing signs of that stress, or people start harvesting the animals that are used to make the vellum that manuscripts and books are created out of. If the genetic diversity of those objects is decreasing, it might tell us something about how people were managing their herds and what kinds of economic pressures they were feeling. So it's a challenge, but I think we have the opportunity to collaborate in teams with scientists. I don't think that scientists are going to come with a huge raft of facts that makes humanists give up on interpreting beautiful works of art or thinking hard about what our lives mean, or what the lives of these people meant who created these precious objects. We do need to be careful with the objects. And one of the most important things about this field is that we've figured out what we would say are non-invasive ways of getting the biological material from the object. We don't destroy the object. And that's important, Kojo, because we want to make these objects accessible. We want to make them accessible to the people who are alive and curious today. But part of your access strategy has to be creating access for people who aren't alive yet. And that's why we conserve the objects. And so there's always a balance. But, you know, there's a range of areas where we've got to work some of this out on the object side. How do we take care of them? But then on the collaboration side, you know, making sure that humanists have the confidence to know that our questions still matter, and that there may be moments in the collaboration where some of the things that we ask about how people made sense of their lives can get some answers with the help of scientists.
Julie Segre?
Yeah, and one, so I do work on the skin microbiome in my own lab. So we have those same questions. How are we going to get a sample from a patient? And our first experiment, we took a biopsy and we took a little shave and we used a swab. And we realized pretty quickly that the patients were most interested in having us swab their skin. So we worked hard on that for 4 years to figure out how to get DNA from a skin swab that would then represent both human DNA and the bacteria, fungi, viruses that lived on that. So one of the questions I was interested in talking with Mike is, we don't have any samples before people started taking antibiotics. What were the microbes on their skin? Did they already have antibiotic resistance genes? Did they already have, like, we now have a lot of Staphylococcus that is resistant to methicillin. Is that something that's always existed on humans, or is that something that came about because of penicillin? So I think it's really this win-win when I have a scientific question and I'm saying, this might be my access to getting old skin and old bacteria that lived on the skin of people 14 generations ago, and that's pre-antibiotics. So part of the excitement of working with people like Mike is that the light bulb goes off for me and I think, wow, this could finally be how I get access to skin samples from people who lived before we started giving them antibiotics. And so it's always the most successful collaborations are when someone starts asking you questions and you think, oh yeah, we worry about those same things when we're taking clinical samples from patients. And then I think, oh, this might really answer a question for me that I thought I would never get access to, these samples.
And I'm glad, Sam Knight, that Julie said this might answer a question for me, because earlier on you said you thought that some of the skepticism about this research is healthy skepticism. Why?
Well, I think we're at a time where different institutions and different historians and different scientists are making new partnerships and carrying out sort of tests that really haven't been done before, and so it was intriguing for me, sort of doing the reporting on this, and you know, we've got papers coming out kind of month by month suggesting different non-invasive techniques for doing this, other techniques which are using sort of smaller and smaller samples. You know, a few years ago, the question was, could you identify the proteins? Now the question is, can you date the proteins? Can you figure out how they're being modified or behaving within an object or within an artwork? So we're at a time of ideas kind of bouncing off each other and sort of being stress tested. And you know, I think that kind of that skepticism is healthy, and it will quite quickly, I hope, you know, produce, you know, durable techniques that people can start using on a broader scale.
Mike, are there plans for future studies of the proteins on documents at the Folger?
We are starting a project with Matthew Collins that Sam mentioned. He mentioned Matthew, who's at Cambridge, to identify a codex, so a bound book that's made of animal skins, and start to think about how many animals went into the creation of that object, because like hair and skin cells, the pages themselves have biological information. And what we want to understand is in a closed-in environment like a monastery where they're creating copies of sacred texts, we would assume that that community has very little traffic with other communities or other countries. And so what we want to understand is as people became more literate and as the printing press started to produce more books, was there a demand for animal skins, because they're printing on animals, that started to distort the way people managed their flocks? Are we seeing skins that are being sourced from other counties or from other countries, far away flocks, so that the genetics of those animals is much further apart?
That's fascinating, and we look forward to having you on again to talk about what you've developed over time. But right now, we're just about out of time. Mike Whitmore is director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Julie Segre is a geneticist and senior investigator in the National Human Genome Research Institute at NIH. Julie, thank you for joining us.
And a proud member of WAMU. Thank you for having us here today. It's really been fascinating to be here.
Thank you for being here. Sam Knight is a staff writer at The New Yorker based in London. Sam Knight, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Today's show on historic documents was produced by Julie Deppenbrock. Coming up tomorrow, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan wants to widen lanes on the Capitol Beltway, but some Montgomery County officials don't. We'll look into how the county plans on fighting the state's plans and if it's possible to find a compromise. And what's the landscape of sports bars in this region? And what do they offer neighborhoods besides cheap beer and wings? Well, we'll explore all of that tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schrobsdorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.